This is The Scoop, a weekly regional roundup of stories from remote radio stations in British Columbia. Each week, The Scoop features news created by fellow LJI journalists in the communities of Smithers, Prince George, Nanaimo, Burnaby, and the Comox Valley. LJI is the local journalism initiative, and it's how your best local news is funded on these participating stations. Now, let's see what's happening this week in BC.
Today on The Scoop, photolithics shine a light on a decade of Tanya Willard's work. Danny Nesverandi at CJSF in Burnaby has more on that story. The Wichita Rare Earths Element Project, endorsed by McLeod Lake Indian Band and developed by Defense Metals, represents a significant potential economic opportunity for Bear Lake, 80 kilometers north of Prince George, and has just been selected for permitting by the Critical Minerals Office. Ian Gregg at CIFR Radio dives in. Bluebirds once could be seen and heard all across the Cowichan Valley, but loss of habitat due to development saw a decline so significant that the bluebirds became locally extinct. Now conservationists are trying to turn the tide. Lauren McKenzie at CHLY Nanaimo has that story. And affordable childcare benchmarks do not meet the North's operating costs and other NCLGA resolutions. Pam Hassan at CICK News in Smithers reports. I'm Daniel Messick, and you're listening to The Scoop.
Reporting from North Vancouver, BC, this is Danny Nesvedarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM. An exhibition that has been years in the making, acclaimed Sakwekum artist, curator, and scholar Tanya Willard's Photolithics is now open for the public at the Polygon Gallery in North Vancouver. The name photolithics is a joining of ancient words for light and stone, which relates to Willard's art practice where the sun and the land often play a vital role. CJSF was invited for a tour of the exhibition, where we were able to walk through the gallery space with Tanya Willard, as well as the exhibit's curators, Monika Shevchek and Serena Steele. The politics and perspectives of photography are a big part of this exhibition, and one specific piece in the exhibition titled Only Available Light encapsulates a significant part of Willard's work in which the settler lens that Indigenous people throughout Canada have been traditionally portrayed through, whether that be through photography or video, is critiqued. Photography is often considered a neutral method of representation. However, the portrayals of Indigenous peoples in Canada, as shown throughout the exhibition, has often been used as a tool of colonization. Here is Willard's explanation of this specific piece.
Another series of work in the exhibition Photolithics, through and through, are recent works that extend a practice and an inquiry that started when I made Only Available Light. That was a long process of me thinking through my Master's of Fine Arts, in which I was looking at anthropometric data and sculptural busts made of Suquamish men in the late 1800s, and the anthropologist Harlan Smith and his role in filmmaking, with a particular film in the late 1920s called The Shuswap Indians of British Columbia. And this was a series of ethnographic films that Smith made of different Indigenous groups. And so one being my nation, Suquamish people. And The Shuswap Indians of British Columbia, I thought, was a really interesting piece because when it was made around 1927, or released, was the years it became mandatory to attend residential school for young Indigenous people. And at the same time, the audience for these films was at the Children's Museum in Ontario, in Ottawa. These films about us living in our traditional ways would be screened to an audience of non-Indigenous people who, you know, were curious, were engaged by our ways, and yet simultaneously that way of living was under attack by residential school systems and cultural genocide policies and assimilation. And so the contrast in that was so disturbing. And also my own, you know, intergenerational kind of experience with day school, residential schools. You know, I'm part of that history and how it affects us today, how it affects all of us. In that work, I wanted to think about healing. I wanted to think about the power of the camera and how it framed us ethnographically for that kind of othering, but also the ways we can take that back.
After the tour, we spoke with Tanya Willard about her process and what she hopes audiences consider when looking through the space that this exhibition has been placed in.
Do you ever think or like have concerns about the way your art is perceived by others that come into this space? You know, like if someone were to not read anything and just look at the photos, they may be like, oh, photography. But, you know, the way that you're speaking about, like, what were the conditions that these photos were taken in? What's the history behind them? Who gets to tell these stories? Who gets to represent indigeneity, especially at that time? I guess, how do you hope audiences, like, perceive this space and interact with it?
Yeah, it's absolutely imperfect, and not everybody is going to understand the complex histories, presence, and futures that I am indicating. But I hope that's also, the work is not only meant to be that, you know? It's also meant to reach out and to speak and it impacts me in my heart and my spirit. And so I'm thinking that at some point, if you're attuned, you might pick up on that. And, you know, when you release the work in this way, it has to speak for itself, and you have to be open to what other people will bring to it. And it might be inattention. It might be, you know, exactly, oh, that's an interesting photo, or it's not an interesting photo. But at a certain point, it's released, and it's in the world, and it's a piece of me in relation to people. And if it's an opportunity and an invitation to go deeper, and if you don't choose that invitation at this point, maybe you will at another point in your life, maybe you won't. You know, it's not everything for everyone. It is a reflection, a moment, a scattering, a refraction, a diffraction, a way of thinking, a way of me spending time with the land, my community, what is valuable to me. And so in the end, it's still great because I've still spent that time. I've still developed those practices. I still developed those tools and strategies, and they will help my community. They will help my family. And so I'm immensely grateful for that.
Once again, that was our conversation with Tanya Willard, the artist behind Photolithics, now open at the Polygon Gallery in North Vancouver. This has been Danny Nesvedarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM.
This is Ian Gregg reporting for CIFA Radio's Due North on 88.7 FM. This initiative is made possible by the Community Radio Fund of Canada through the Local Journalism Initiatives Program. Find our news stories online at frequencynews.ca or CFUR.ca. The community of Bear Lake, roughly 80 kilometers north of the city of Prince George, has experienced hardship with Canfor's Polar Sawmill closing in 2024, though a different project entered the horizon at approximately the same time. With the endorsement of McLeod Lake Indian Band, Defense Metals announced its Wichita Rare Earth Element project. Expected to begin producing in approximately the year 2030, the rare earth element mine could be providing materials needed for the manufacture of rare earth magnets, electric vehicles, cell phones, medical equipment, and a wide array of other technology. Further strengthening the prospect of this development, the BC government's Critical Minerals Office announced on February 23, 2026, that the Wichita Rare Earth Element Project has been selected as an advanced project, one of three in the province. We reached out to the Critical Minerals Office, hoping to secure an interview with BC Minister of Mining and Critical Minerals, Jagrup Brar, on the subject. We instead received the following statement attributed to the Ministry of Mining and Critical Minerals. I'll read a few points as follows. To begin, BC has a generational opportunity to drive growth and create new jobs across the entire critical mineral value chain, from mining to manufacturing to recycling. Early coordination with the support of BC's Critical Minerals Office helps ensure quicker permitting through clear communication and stronger alignment between government, communities, First Nations, and project proponents as critical minerals projects move toward environmental assessment and permitting. These three new projects, North Isle Copper and Gold's North Island Project, Surge Copper's Berg Projects, Defense Metals' Wichita Project, have the potential to support jobs and drive economic growth throughout the region for decades, in line with the lifespans of these mines. And finally, while it's only a preliminary estimate, Defense Metals' Wichita Project alone is anticipated to support 400 construction jobs and a further 200 permanent jobs over the life of the mine. End statement. While CIFR Radio was not able to secure an appointment with the Critical Minerals Office, we were able to speak with President and CEO of Defense Metals, Mark Torrey, who joined us over video conference. Thanks for joining us today, Mark.
Thanks, Ian. It's great to be here.
What are some of the uses for these rare earth elements?
I mean, rare earths go into a lot of things. It includes defense, robotics, all the EVs that you talked about, wind turbines, certainly all the greening of the economy.
As I understand it, on the projected timeline, the opening date will fall into 2030. What can you tell us about what this designation means for the project and Defense Metals from the Critical Minerals Office?
Yeah, look, it's one of those things. You've been obviously working with both the provincial government and the federal government to ensure that defence is really high up on their radar to try and progress the project, you know, as quickly as possible. And so we've been getting some great support from both the provincial government and the federal government. And what this does is it actually recognises, you know, our project's strengths and the level of advancement that we actually are. It enables us to look at syncing our technical progress with a clear regulatory pathway right from the outset. So, you know, as we work with First Nations rights holders plus the provincial government, you know, we're going to ensure that our project advances in the fastest way possible.
Rare earth metals are a hot topic these days with a combination of tech sector and manufacturing demand, an ongoing trade dispute with the USA, et cetera. I understand most rare earth minerals originate from China, correct me if I'm wrong, but what minerals are you hoping to bring to the table with Wichita, and is BC positioned to take advantage of this production with either delivery mechanisms, refining, manufacturing capacity? Essentially, will we end up shipping the raw product out to somewhere, or what sort of value-added processes are we positioned to offer? Where does this world of rare earth elements happen? Where's the center of it?
Well, you're right. I mean, China at the moment dominates all the downstream industry in particular. As you go further downstream in the rare earth processing chain, China has over 90% of production of like rare earth magnets, for example. So what we're looking at here is trying to develop as much of a downstream industry as possible within Canada. And obviously, you know, within BC, if we can. And that, it, you know, for us, it includes going down as a first stage to what we call a neodymium praseodymium oxide. So just shortening it to NDPR, which makes it easy for everybody. You know, that NDPR oxide then goes into an alloy maker that goes into a metal maker that then goes into a magnet. So that's sort of the whole downstream process. And, you know, we're hoping to get as much of that process into Canada as possible. For us as Defense Metals, we're trying to get that first stage first of just getting to that NDPR oxide.
As a mine, as a proponent of actually extracting the minerals, what mechanisms do you feel you're able to leverage to try to get some of these value-added processes into BC, into Canada? How does the big machine work?
well, as you mentioned in the question, you know, China's dominated. You know, we're having issues with the US, so there needs to be a surety of supply. I think not only just outside of China, but also outside of the US. You know, the recent strengthening of relationships with the EU and Canada. Is a real positive in relation to the potential for us to go to the EU and the EU to come into us and invest in that downstream processing.
Again, the Critical Minerals Office of British Columbia announced February 23, 2026, that the Defense Metal Corporation's Wachita project would work with the CMO to support early coordination as the project prepares for environmental assessment and future permitting processes. One of three other projects selected for advancement, including North Isle Copper and Gold's North Island project and Surge Copper Corporation's Berg project. We were not able to secure comment from a McLeod Lake Indian Band representative in time for deadline. This is Ian Gregg reporting for CIFA Radio's Due North on 88.7 FM.
This is a CHY News Update. Bluebirds could have once been seen and heard all across the Cowichan Valley. But the loss of habitat due to development saw a decline so significant that bluebirds became locally extinct. Cowichan Valley conservationists, seeing the devastating loss of bluebirds in the area, started the Bring Back the Bluebirds project. The project, started in 2012, seeks to reintroduce a flourishing population of bluebirds, while also fostering the stewardship of Gary Oak ecosystems. Jackie Taylor is the project coordinator for the BC Conservation Foundation, who oversees the Cowichan Bring Back the Birds project.
So they were so common that the local newspaper had an article, this is in the 50s, I believe, saying, "We know it's spring because the bluebirds are everywhere," right? So that was how common they were at that time. And they were all through southern Vancouver Island in Victoria and the Gulf Islands as well. And the populations all along the coast had pummeled through the 70s and into the 90s as people developed the Gary Oak habitats and the nesting cavities that they relied on were lost.
The Western bluebird is the only species of bluebird found on Vancouver Island and the Gulf Islands. Male bluebirds can be identified by their bright blue color and orange chest, while females have a more gray coloration, with blue highlights throughout their body and a peachy colored breast. Taylor says the Western bluebird was once labeled as extirpated, meaning the species was locally extinct to the Vancouver Island and Gulf Island area, while the rest of the population in North America was doing fine.
They rely on cavity nesting holes that are built by woodpeckers in oaks here. They can also go in pine trees and other places, but they can't build their own holes. And so when people are taking down the old oaks to build homes and buildings, they lost their cavity nesting holes. And so they had nowhere to nest, and so their population just dwindled until it was gone.
The project is focused near Quamichin and Somnus Lake in the Cowichan Valley and uses a conservation area that is not open to the public for their work. Taylor says their work is to build a secure population of bluebirds in the area.
So secure looks like we have enough birds returning each year on their own that even if a few birds are lost or predated on or there's a bad season, the population will recover itself. Right now, what happens is if we had brought the numbers up, we stopped translocations and the population crashed again. Mm. And so we want to see some resilience in the population. We want to see the return rates high enough that it will grow itself.
She says this work can be done due to very early conservation of the biodiverse Gary Oak ecosystems. These ecosystems are where Gary Oak trees naturally occurred before European settlement. CHY joined Taylor in the field visiting the conservation site to look for early signs of bluebirds.
Do bluebirds have a very distinctive call?
Yes. So it's
because they sort of like sing.
They do, but this, what I tend to hear more right now is their contact call, which sounds like a little pew, pew. Like.
Since 2012, the project has been translocating pairs and families of bluebirds from Washington State to grow the local population. The project also supports the population by supplementing nesting cavities with wooden nest boxes and using supplementary food sources to make sure the birds are receiving enough food.
This is a feeder made by one of our volunteers. So this mesh is the right size for a bluebird to fit in, but too small for starlings. And so we give them daily rations of mealworms. And the reason is, I mean, there is enough food to support them here, but But having that little bit of extra makes it more likely that they'll have two clutches in a season instead of just one.
And clutches is like the eggs.
Yeah, so they'll lay usually about 5 or 6 eggs, and then they'll raise those young until they fledge, and then if they have enough energy and they're all doing well, then they'll have a second clutch of eggs, which they'll raise.
The project also has an Adopt a Nest program, where by donation, supporters can adopt a nest, receiving updates and photos of the bluebird family who nest there over the season. As the population continues to grow, Taylor says she's excited to see what will come next for the songbird population in the Cowichan Valley. For CHY News, this is Laura McKenzie.
This is CICK News. Today on CICK News, a brief look at the motions, resolutions, decisions, and delegations from the Town of Smithers Tuesday, March 10th Council meeting. Council endorsed 2 resolutions to be forwarded to the North Central Local Government Association, or NCLGA. One calls for improvements to Crown land processes, and another asks for construction cost adjustments in provincial funding programs. Here's Town of Smithers Director of Corporate Services speaking on those 2 resolutions.
Hi there, my name is David Shorter. I am the Director of Corporate Services for the Town of Smithers. So last night, Council endorsed 2 resolutions from the North Central Local Government Association. So 2 policies that we're putting forward to add to our regional association's advocacy priorities. So the first is Crown land, use of Crown land prior to local government land for provincial projects. And really what's thought out of this is that when the provincial government is seeking land for bigger projects, such as the long-term care facility here in Smithers that's being developed, different BC housing projects, whether that be the projects that's intended for Alfred Avenue, or some of the ones that we've seen at the old L.B. Warner site, that they look towards their own land inventory, particularly Crown land, to see what is available prior to asking municipalities for that land. As if they do this for long enough, continue to ask municipalities, we just end up with a dwindling supply of land resources to use for our own purposes. Additionally, the second resolution that was endorsed was the regional construction cost adjustments in provincial funding programs. And this actually stems from when the Town of Smithers applied for funding to develop a daycare in partnership with the YMCA about a year and a half ago. And one of the major reasons that our application was denied was that the project costs to develop the land for the use of a daycare were higher when compared to places south of Smithers. And really what's driving this is that costs, whether it be labor, the materials to bring up, or just some of the other costs that go into developing in the Town of Smithers, are higher than costs down south in Vancouver and other metro areas. So what we're asking the province to consider is just that when you're looking at projects in the north, to consider the northern cost allocations that are reasonably put into those.
Mayor Attrill also acknowledged the speedy and thorough response from the emergency crews in the region from Saturday night's windstorm.
I wanted also to thank our staff and all those involved in the emergency over the weekend with the power outage. As we know, our EOC was activated. So thanks to everyone who put in extra time, keeping the community and its well-being at heart, and to those folks who are not our staff, but those hydro crews, I think, deserve little medals too.
Councillors debated a resolution asking the province to review Northern Child Care affordability benchmarks. This motion ultimately failed in a 4-2 vote, opposed by Councillors Patterson and Elliott, after concerns that it would create financial challenges for local child care providers. Here's Councillors Elliott, Ray, and Patterson discussing at the March 10th meeting.
Thank you, Your Worship. So I'll start with the Northern Child Care Affordability Benchmarks. I had a really great meeting with the Child Development Center just around trying to ensure that I adequately understand the impacts that these lower benchmarks have, so specific to the northern area in our community. And I was a bit astounded, I guess, at not recognizing how severe the impacts were. All of the other programs that are available to childcare providers currently outside of the $10 a day in order to be able to provide affordable quality childcare to families is severely impacted by how low that Northern affordability benchmark is. And so what the CDC and other people that I've talked to in the community are saying is that, one, people are actually no longer providing affordable childcare, or they're just not entering into affordable childcare. So what that means is the affordability benchmark is essentially the rate in which you can charge families in order to then cover your operational costs. That rate in which you're charging families does not even anywhere close to cover your operating costs in order to be able to provide adequate childcare. And I think it's important to note how disproportionately we are just based on the value versus what the rest of the province gets. It's roughly a $10 to $20 discrepancy.
Well, I think it's kind of one of those things where the North, just people don't understand the North. They look, oh, the housing's cheaper, but they don't see that there isn't any available or things like that, or they don't know what the rents are.
Yeah, I just want to second what Councillor Patterson is saying. I think this is a pretty important issue for most communities, and I think the government has done a dismal job of rolling out the $10 a day childcare and left a lot of people in the lurch now with basically defunding this program.
Here's David Schroeder again.
The rationale for not endorsing this resolution was that the provincial government is actually putting a stop to the $10 a day childcare program. And because of that, we didn't feel that right now was the right time to be seeking a policy at NCLGA and UBCM that would seek to change the way that funding was allocated, and that the bigger priority would be to advocate with the provincial government towards maintaining that funding or providing funding in a different way. Essentially, because of that change, it's likely that that topic will come back again at a later advocacy discussion of this council.
That's it for this week's Scoop. Catch us next week, Thursdays at 12 p.m. in Smithers, Thursdays at 4 p.m. in Burnaby, Fridays at 8 a.m. in Nanaimo, and weekdays at 7:30 in Prince George. The Scoop was made possible by funding from the Canadian government and the Local Journalism Initiative, a Community Radio Fund of Canada initiative.